Let me introduce you to my next guest, Professor Mary Beard. She's become one of the country's most famous historians, some would say infamous, partly through her books and partly through her fascinating TV documentaries about ancient Rome. Well, her new book, SPQR, is a riveting history of the period. Mary, welcome to the programme. How did your fascination with Rome begin?
Oh, it began when I was taken to British Museum by my mum when I was five. And in fact, I was really more of a Greek child than a Roman one, because I saw the Elgin Marbles and I thought, wow, you know, that's amazing.
It was as simple as that. You never looked back since.
And I never looked back. I became then a rather sort of nerdy child who turned out to be rather good at Latin, although I wanted to be exciting and freewheeling, but in fact, I was a bit of a swot.
Now, you've recently done a debate with Boris Johnson on Rome versus Greece, haven't you? I mean, just take us back to how Rome actually began. It was a little village, wasn't it?
Rome, when it starts, let's say 8th century BC, it's a dump, actually. It's a tiny little nondescript village by the Tiber. And the real question about Rome is not... Everybody wants to ask, why did the Roman Empire fall? The real question is, why did this dump of a village actually grow to be a world empire within, you know, a rather terrifyingly short space of time, a few centuries?
And how did it develop in its infrastructure and the buildings? How did that all happen?
Well, I think you have to be pretty clear about what Rome isn't. Yes, we have this Hollywood vision of Rome. Marble, great city, you know, people walking around in very clean togas, running the world. Now, eventually it became that. But the period while it's getting its empire, it is a rather run-down, local stone, ramshackle, unplanned kind of place. You'd never imagine that it ran the world. And the real question is, you know, why? You know, how do they actually do it? And in a way, that's what the book tries at least to come close to an answer to.
Now, the book, as I say, is called SPQR. I mean, it's a massive doorstop of a book, isn't it? And what does SPQR stand for?
Yeah, it stands for Senatus Populusque Romanus.
So glad I asked.
Which means the Senate and Roman people. And why I chose that is because that's how Rome called itself. When Rome wanted to talk about itself, it talked about itself as Senatus Populusque Romanus. And it becomes such a famous abbreviation that you go to Rome now and you still see it on the manhole covers, the litter bins in the centre of the city. It is the longest living acronym in the history of the world, and it still stands for Rome.
So in terms of the period that we're talking about, and you look around the rest of the world, I mean, what was rivaling Rome?
The big rivals in the West, leaving aside China, the direct rivals, were most of all Carthage, a city in North Africa, famous now to most people, I think, because of Hannibal the Carthaginian's invasion of Rome with his elephants across the Alps, but various of the Greek powers who had grown up more or less successfully after the great campaigns, or the bloody campaigns, of Alexander the Great. And Rome, one by one, gets the better of all those rivals. And she does it, really, because... Rome gets more manpower. I mean, in the end, ancient battles are not won by very clever tactics or, you know, expensive military hardware. They're won by boots on the ground. And Rome manages to get more boots on the ground so that she loses plenty of battles. Everybody thinks the Romans are invincible. They're not invincible in battle, but they don't lose wars.
And when we think of Rome, we think of one or two key personalities, I suppose. Who were the key people involved in bringing about the Roman Empire?
How long's
a piece of string, I suppose?
One of the reasons I called my book The Senate and Roman People is I'm trying to say, look, OK, there are some big, actually rather charismatic and glamorous, although also murderous, big men. But in a sense, it's a communal operation that gets Rome going. It is about Rome as a polity, as a society, as a group of citizens, all fighting for the community. So now we can think of some very well known in the Roman world characters, people like the Scipio family, who between them sent the Carthaginians packing, and one of whom famously destroyed the city of Carthage in 146 BC, absolutely wrecked it, burnt it to the ground. It was left as nothing, and was seen watching the flames. A friend of his says to him, because he spots he's crying, he says, "Why are you crying, Scipio?" Scipio says, "Well, basically, that's going to happen to Rome one day, isn't it?" So they're other kind of wry, reflective characters, as well as being butchers.
And how do you research a book like this? Because in one part of it, in the introduction, you say this can only ever really be an interim history, because we're discovering new things all the time, which I found fascinating. You'd have thought, well, haven't we discovered everything we would ever know about ancient Rome?
Do we actually need a new history of Rome? That's the question. Well, yes, we do, partly because actually the appliance of science is giving us loads and loads of new information. I mean, just to take Rome and Britain, some of the most interesting work is being done on the teeth of the skeletons discovered here, which can show you where those people were likely to have been born. So you can start now to do something you could never have done even a decade ago, which is somehow to plot migration, plot patterns of movement within the Roman Empire. Still pretty rough science, but it's something which is really going to help us think, what are the people of the Roman Empire like?
And the Roman influence on this country is still there, isn't it? I can remember as a five-year-old child, somebody would say, "How old's your mother?" And I would say, I mean, I can't have even been conscious of the Roman Empire. I would say, "Oh, she's as old as the Romans."
Yes. Well,
and there are still sayings in our language that emanate from that time, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And also, I mean, I think...
Pyrrhic victory, I think, is one.
Yeah, Pyrrhic victory, fearing the Greeks, bearing gifts. And Julius Caesar's assassination remains the classic assassination against which every other political assassination is still modelled. Mm. But I think it's also more mundane than that. And I think in Britain, I think it's kind of the way the geography of the country is still formed by the Romans. I mean, why is the capital in London? It's not actually a terribly sensible place to have a capital. It's because that's where the Romans put it. And all those towns that still end in Caster, Doncaster or Chester, Manchester, that's a wonderful little giveaway, that ending, Caster or Chester, to the fact that they were once Roman places.
And how did the Romans first come here?
Julius Caesar kind of did it as a dare. Britain, before the Romans ever got here, was actually extremely exotic place to the Romans. It was across what we call the English Channel, and they thought of it as the ocean. It was kind of, going to Britain was almost like space travel for the Romans. And Caesar comes here, actually to damn well show he could. And he gets across, and he doesn't stay terribly long. He does it twice, but, he's reached that really, exotic place where all the people are 10 foot tall and it snows all the time. So it's a great voyage of exploration.
And that's just Manchester.
he hardly got further than London. Actually, the guy who really conquers the place is the Emperor Claudius. And he does it because he was kind of put on the throne, and he was a bit old and a bit disabled and totally unglamorous, and he needed a conquest. So he sends his guys off to conquer Britain, because it was sort of a sitting target.
It is interesting, isn't it, that in this country, we know a lot of names from that period. I mean, you've mentioned some of them, Caligula, sort of lots of others that we could think of. And I can't think of any names really from the rest of the world from that period. I mean, was the rest of the world just sort of somewhere that was unknown, that it was just this happened to be one of the first civilizations?
I think Rome has always been in our heads, and it's been in our heads in a sense, almost continually ever since. And we did eventually rediscover the Greek world, but it's actually, apart from Alexander the Great, you know, names like Pericles or Demosthenes, they don't exactly have brand recognition, whereas Nero, Fiddling While Rome Burns, Caligula, Julius Caesar, even Romulus and Remus still actually say something to us. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was partly to bust a few myths about those people who still float in and out of our consciousness, but also to say, what do they really do?
Well, I was going to come on to that, because you do puncture a few myths. I mean, Cleopatra's death being one of them. And just talk us through that and maybe one or two others.
Well, Cleopatra's death, I mean, I don't want to give up the myth entirely. Because
it's a good myth.
It's a good myth that, you know, there she is. She's, you know, thinks she's lost her lover. They've been defeated. It's in the middle of a Roman civil war, effectively. But Antony and Cleopatra, they were already creating themselves as great love story. And the story is that when she thinks that Antony's dead, rather than be taken prisoner by the Romans, she commits suicide. But she does it by having a couple of snakes brought in a bowl of fruit. As you do, right? And they bite her. And, of course, in the story, she, slightly glamorously, fades away. And they're always called asps. Yeah. I'm never quite sure what an asp is, but they're called asps.
They're good for carry-on films.
Yes, that's right. But I think it is pretty clear, so scientists tell me, that it is very, very hard indeed to kill yourself with a pair of snakes brought in the bowl of fruit. So I'm afraid that one has to kind of say, we have to say bye-bye to that. I think also we have to say bye-bye to just some of the, you know, the really exciting wickednesses of Roman emperors. And Caligula's, you know, always the best, you know, it's an extraordinary story of how one of the things he's supposed to have done, also flirting with the conquest of Britain, he sends his soldiers up to the Channel. And then, according to the story, he suddenly changes his mind and has these tough Roman squaddies pick up seashells on the beach. And everybody says, you know, that's the kind of, you know, completely arbitrary, bonkers emperor he was, you know, getting good old Roman squaddies to collect shells. And that's almost certainly a misunderstanding, because the Roman word for seashells is very, 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 very similar to the Roman word for military huts. It looks as if he probably had them just, you know, decamp,
well,
I'm afraid.
That's another myth busted. Mary, thank you very much indeed. Mary Beard's book is called SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome, published by Profile, £25 in hardback. Mary, thanks.
Thank you.